This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds.
This month I talk with Dr. Fiona Radford and Dr. Petta Greenfield, hosts of the wildly popular podcast, The Partial Historians, as we delve into the history of the mountain, the town, and the very famous eruption. You can learn more about The Partial Historians at partialhistorians.com and find their enlightening episodes on all major podcast platforms. Now, to the year 79 AD.
It's really interesting. I'm currently in Texas, of all places, and down here in Houston, at the Natural History Museum, there is a huge Pompeii exhibit that everybody has been going to and talking about. The only issue is apparently it does a whole simulation that's really intense. Like, very
solid. So you get to experience what it might be like to be in the eruption. Wow.
Yes, yes. And I think it's interesting for a lot of people because I think most people just think it's, you know, it was just an eruption and they don't realize kind of the whole timeline of the event. But I think it's much more interesting because it is a longer event than just like boom, eruption, everybody's buried. And because there is that, you know, delay in events, you kind of have eyewitnesses and things like that. But I think probably a more interesting place to start, first and foremost, is the city itself. Because Pompeii wasn't necessarily a spectacular city. I don't know, maybe, what do you guys think about the city of Pompeii? Maybe fill in everybody a little bit on the history of Pompeii.
Yeah, I definitely think that Pompeii has mostly become a spectacular city because of the way that it was preserved. A bit like how Tutankhamun wasn't really that spectacular a pharaoh, but what's made him really useful for historians and archaeologists is the fact that his tomb was preserved in such a good state in comparison to other pharaohs. But yes, Pompeii certainly wasn't this, you know, amazingly wealthy or large place. What do you think, Dr. G?
Yeah, it's kind of like this sort of like middling kind of town.
Yeah.
But it is like an important location. So yes, it's set at the mouth of the Sarnus River, which means that it ends up being a trade town, essentially. And this is fantastic for the sorts of things that we find later. There's lots of evidence that backs up its position as a trade town. So we see this also not just in its location, but also in the composition of the population. So the history of Pompeii, we know that it's existed since around about the 6th, 5th century BCE. And it seems that there's like this combination of people of a Greek background and local indigenous Italian peoples as well. So we've got some Oscans there, we've got some Etruscans there, and we also have some Samnites there. And it turns out that as the history of Pompeii progresses, the Samnite people actually start to step out as the big players in the town. And this means that Pompeii is kind of at a crossroads with Rome. Because Rome starts to grow into the broader Campania region and its influence is spreading in kind of like the 2nd century BC. But Pompeii doesn't want anything to do with them. They're like, they're not our people. We're not up for that kind of stuff. In fact, we don't have Latins here, really. It's not a big percentage of their population. And they actually oppose Roman influence on quite a number of occasions. And so they're involved in the Samnite Wars in opposition to Rome. And then they're involved in the social war, which is in like the late 1st century. And they lose in that instance. Aww. And that's the point at which Rome starts to, I know, sad times. That's the part where Rome starts to assert its ascendancy in the area. So it's got this really interesting background of diversity, trade, Roman opposition as all part of its history.
And being, I think, in the Campanian region, I mean, it's not a bad place to be. it would be a really nice place to live, being in Campania. And as Dr. G has highlighted, with all the trade that's possible because of its location, it definitely was a prosperous place to be on the whole.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I guess I always thought in a way, and obviously just completely erroneously, because now Rome is so successful and so big in history that Pompeii might have just been, you know, a suburb town, an outskirt, you know, when you just sort of replant sort of modern situations like Pompeii's a day trip kind of thing to anybody who's going to Rome. So the fact that it was competitive with Rome, I guess I was trying to think of like a modern equivalent to what it would be like to Rome. I guess originally I was thinking maybe it's like Jersey to New York or something, but maybe instead it's like Montreal to New York.
Well, even today, if you think about the relationship between Rome and Naples, they are very distinct peoples as far as they're concerned. Naples is Naples and it has Napoli stuff going on, and Rome is Rome and it has its own stuff going on. And they understand each other, but they see themselves as quite distinct as well. And I think the way that we see modern relationships within Italy play out is actually a really good model for thinking about how it is in the ancient period as well. Like, people hold fast to the land that they come from. It's very important to them. And there's a whole history and language embedded in that as well. So if we're thinking about the Oscan people and the Etruscans, they have a different language system. So there's points where that communication isn't working. And for Rome, I mean, they're increasingly getting big for their boots, aren't they? We know that. They forcibly kind of spread all through Italy. And that last century of the BC period, that is a really big moment for consolidation for Rome within Italy and trying to figure out what those relationships look like, often through force. And one of the things that we see happen with Pompeii is that when they fail in the social war, Sulla gets involved and ends up setting up a colony of Latins, Romans, next door pretty much. We're not sure about the exact location and how much commingling there is of those populations, but it seems that Rome takes a really strong position in trying to dominate that region from that point onwards.
And certainly some of the buildings that you see spring up in that time period after the social wars does suggest that Rome is really trying to assert dominance within the town. So things like the Temple of Venus being constructed after Pompeii officially becomes a colony. Venus is someone that had particular connections to Sulla. And so you can kind of see a remaking as well of some of the other major temples. And so definitely you can see how the townscape starts to change as Rome becomes more and more involved in that latter period just before its destruction.
And before we get to its destruction, I mean, that was not the first time Pompeii had experienced a natural disaster, right? Before the actual eruption, they had a big earthquake, and that sort of affected the town quite significantly even before it got buried, right?
There is quite a lot of scholarly debate about exactly how much of an impact the earthquake had on the town. There's definitely been scholars who have thought that Pompeii was a city in decline, that after the earthquake, a lot of people who could move did and, you know, sort of left the region, and that has started to transform the way that people were living in the town. But there are also people who see a lot of signs of rebuilding and the fact that obviously not everybody would have had the means to pick up and move. You know, you can't just leave the town that you have lived and your family's probably lived for a while just because there has been an earthquake. And earthquakes are common. I mean, this earthquake was obviously severe enough that it did cause a lot of damage and it did cause a lot of issues for the people. So it was obviously a disaster of a different nature. But certainly, even with that in consideration, not everybody who lives in Pompeii is going to be prosperous enough to leave everything behind and go and live somewhere else. So definitely, this is an ongoing, I think, area of debate about exactly what was happening in Pompeii as a result of the earthquake.
Yeah, I was going to ask if that was an opportunity for Rome to rebuild there and give their sort of presence extra, because I know they did some rebuilding after the earthquake, if that would be a moment when they'd say, okay, you have to rebuild anyway, so maybe do it like we like it.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things, yeah, private houses as well as public buildings were going through some redecoration and restoration after the earthquake, and not all of them were buildings that you would say were, say, typically Roman. So, for example, the Temple of Isis was one of the buildings that started receiving attention in the aftermath of the earthquake, and that I think that was a cult. I mean, obviously, it wasn't just Pompeii that was getting on board with the cult of Isis, but it does seem to have been a cult that had a particular presence in Pompeii, and possibly because of its location as a kind of trading city where you have people bringing in outside influences, you know, on a regular basis. You know, it does have exposure to a wide variety of cultures as well as the local cultures.
And I guess at this point, it might be good to us to get to the eruption itself. Like, maybe you guys can walk us through the events as they happened.
Sure. Well, it's probably good to highlight that with some of the recent finds, I'm sure your listeners are probably aware that the date of the eruption is now being fairly widely debated, and I think we feel more certain than we ever have before that the famous date of August 24th is now actually probably not the date that the eruption took place. It's now thought to have happened sometime in October, which is quite a bit later than people were theorizing even a couple of years ago. I mean, I used to tell my students that it was probably September, but now it's been pushed back to October because of some writing that's been found in the site recently. But even so, basically, it was quite a lengthy experience. I think it would have been obviously absolutely terrifying because it lasted for such a long time. But one of our big sources, obviously, is Pliny. We've got his letters that tell us a little bit about what was happening. So he wasn't actually in Pompeii or Herculaneum, the two famous cities that were destroyed, luckily. Hence, we have his eyewitness account.
You.
He was actually located a little distance away. Yeah, he was located a little distance away at a place called Misenum. And so what we are sort of basing our reconstruction on is partly his account and partly also the actual archaeological record, like the stratigraphy of the site. There probably would have been, for people who were a bit closer than Pliny the Younger, some signs that something was wrong a bit earlier than he starts recording them. So there probably would have been, we imagine, some obviously like ground tremors, some sharp shocks happening. And then that would have been obviously a sign that the pressure was building up inside of Vesuvius, because one of the things that makes the 79 eruption so catastrophic is the fact that Vesuvius hadn't actually exploded for a really long time by the time the 79 eruption came about. And so it is kind of like one of my teachers used this imagery, which I think is always very useful. It was kind of a bit like a champagne bottle with a cork that was stuck. So when the eruption started to happen, there was a plug in there that wasn't easily dislodged. So there was a lot of pressure probably building behind that plug. And that's when people probably started noticing something wasn't quite right if they were close enough to Vesuvius to sort of feel ground tremors and that sort of thing. But gradually, obviously, the plug is dislodged and then you start to see a volcanic cloud starting to form. And because, again, there is so much pressure coming out, it starts to go up, you know, reasonably high in the sky, and you've basically got this sort of stem supporting all this volcanic material, and so you start to get this sort of mushroom cloud forming because there's so much pressure underneath it, and this is what we call the Plinian phase of the eruption, because this is where Pliny starts to notice it, and he described it really well. I mean, for a long time I don't think people really believed his account, because it's not necessarily, you know, every volcano doesn't erupt the same way, and this is obviously, as I say, a particularly bad eruption. But he starts to notice this volcanic cloud forming in the sky. By the time he saw it, though, it was probably already about 15 kilometers in the sky, you know, so it's really building up. And for the people that are living in the area, again, depending on where you were because of the wind direction and that sort of thing, but some people would have started to experience debris being dropped on their city, whereas others would have probably experienced very little just because of the wind direction, but they would have seen obviously what was happening. And as time goes on, the cloud just builds more and more. And by the time Pliny noticed it, we think it was probably at about midday. So it's in the middle of the day. But as the cloud builds and builds, it starts to affect, you know, the perception of this being day. You know, it starts to really take over, and it starts to obviously become an incredibly frightening sort of situation. Pompeii certainly would have been experiencing some of the ash fall in the sort of late afternoon on the first day whenever it happened, and pumice would have been falling, and it's falling quite, you know, relatively heavily at a relatively fast rate. But certainly at this stage, if you were in the towns, you probably could have escaped at this point in time. You know, this would have been a good time to, you know,
get out of Dodge.
Yeah, to go get your stuff and get out.
Get out of here, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because once that pumice starts falling, it starts to build up as well. It's a very unusual experience for people because they start to notice that the sediment buildup that's falling out of the sky is increasing over time. So the size of it is getting larger as well. And so it's becoming a huge problem. The longer that people wait, the more likely it is that they're not going to get out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of by the evening on the first day, early evening, that we think that there was enough pumice and ash falling on the town from Vesuvius that roofs would have started to collapse. So this is when it would have started getting real, if it hadn't already, for a lot of people. And also, of course, in order to get out of your house, you know, it's a bit like snow, you know, you don't want to let the level of sediment build up too high so that you're, you know, walled into your house by volcanic material. So this is where I think if it hadn't started to hit home for people, it really would have. And also the size of what is falling is also starting to get, you know, increasingly serious. I mean, some of this stuff is some of the stuff that was originally falling is probably fairly small, but it starts to get larger. And sometimes we're talking about things that are, you know, the size of a fist, you know, maybe even a little bit bigger. So certainly enough that if it hit someone on the head, it could kill you. So it's, yeah, definitely increasingly
you almost
dangerous.
Wonder why anybody was there at the end point. Like, why didn't everybody leave?
I think if you saw that initial sort of ash fall, you would maybe assume that all of the cloud was of that kind of density. And if that was the interpretation that you went with, not having seen an eruption like this before and having no recorded experience to inform you about what might be coming next, you might just assume that you could wait it out. It's like, it's a big ash cloud. Sure, you know, not great, but it'll clear in time. And it's when that larger pumice starts to fall and those larger pieces of rock where it's like, actually, it now becomes a hazard to leave your place if you've decided to stay. And you might think to yourself, it might be prudent to stay inside, which would be a mistake because potentially your roof will cave in. But there is more to come as well, as I await Fiona.
Yes.
Dr. Rad to let me know.
I just wanted to say that, yeah, I agree. Like, it's obviously one of the big mysteries of the destruction of Pompeii and Herculaneum, for that matter, about why was there anybody left in the town? Because at first, when people started, you know, excavating the sites and they found bodies, they just used common sense, obviously, to go, oh, well, there are some bodies here. Probably people who were too sick or too old or had some sort of disability or people who had young children, or, you know, that was kind of the assumption. But in the last, you know, 40 to 50 years, now that we've actually been able to study the skeletons much more scientifically, it has been revealed that that's not the case at all. That these were people who were seemingly very capable of leaving, like a real cross-section of the population. Like, sure, there were some older people there, but there were quite a lot of people who were teenagers, who were in their 20s. There's quite a mix of men and women. And so why these people stayed when lots of other people left, because obviously the vast majority of the people who lived in Pompeii and Herculaneum survived, the vast majority. Population numbers are always a bit, you know, speculative, and it's a bit hard to figure out, but certainly most people survived. So most people left. Why did these people stay behind? I don't think there'll ever be a satisfactory answer to that question, unfortunately. But anyway, essentially, as it starts to get deep into the night, so, you know, people have been obviously living in this time where day became night. You know, if you're living in Pompeii, the ash is falling. If you live in Herculaneum, obviously it would have been very dark. It would have been very scary. And obviously, you know, you've been living in this darkness for a while. Sometime in around midnight or so, maybe a little bit before, the first pyroclastic surge happens. And this essentially starts to happen because there's been a lot of pressure building up underneath that volcanic cloud that has just been going higher and higher into sky. I mean, by this stage, it's probably like 30 kilometers in this, you know, high in the sky. And it's just spreading out and spreading out into this like big mushroom shape. But the material that's coming out of the volcano is starting to become heavier. It's starting to, starting to get into the denser volcanic material. And so essentially the stem that has been pushing that up into the sky, it can't hold it forever because that cloud is getting heavier. And so that's what you start to get with this type of volcanic eruption. Eventually that cloud will collapse, okay? And that's what we call a pyroclastic surge. And that will happen a number of times with Vesuvius, because once it has a collapse, it then starts to kind of, it's like a relief of pressure. It's like, oh, and then it can start building up again because it's still got more to come. Anyway, so the first pyroclastic surge, we think, hits Herculaneum. And essentially what this means is that the people who haven't managed to escape are engulfed in searing hot temperatures. We think now, based on the evidence that is, you know, is being studied, that probably between 400 to 500 degrees Celsius, you know, so this is extreme, as well as obviously the noxious gases that come out of, yeah, it's pretty horrific. Now, for some people who were still in Herculaneum, they had taken shelter, and so they were a little bit more insulated. I mean, there is no running from a pyroclastic surge like this. That's, you know, those temperatures, you're not going to survive even if you're inside, but they're a little bit more sheltered than some people who were actually standing out on the beach. So the people who were standing out on the beach, it obviously would have been over very, very quickly, you know, probably within the space of a breath, you know, they would have just been like, and just over. And it would have been, absolutely extreme for their bodies as well. Certainly we can see the effects of the extreme heat, and the exposure of that extreme heat hitting their bodies, definitely. The people who were inside taking shelter, it might have been actually long enough for them to actually maybe feel it, which is a pretty horrific thought. It's, again, still an area of study, still a bit of debate, but they might have been alive a little bit longer. But certainly it was all over very quickly. Now, Pompeii is a little bit further away than Herculaneum, and it lies in a slightly different direction. And so things start to linger on over there. I mean, there obviously, if you're still in the town by this stage, you know, the ashfall is considerable. I mean, it's, you know, it's really building up by this stage, and the volcanic material that is falling, it's getting heavier, it's getting more serious. Roofs would have been collapsing all over the place. But sometime probably in the early morning on the second day, for the people that were still sheltering or existing somewhere in Pompeii, there is a surge that actually manages to hit Pompeii, because basically each time this cloud collapses, it gets sort of more erratic, I suppose. It gets more destructive, and so it starts to reach further and further out. There'll eventually be, we think, six surges, and each one has a bigger radius as the volcano destabilizes more and more. And so we think it was possibly around the third or maybe the fourth surge that hits Pompeii. And so anybody who was left alive, you know, who hadn't, you know, been hit on the head, or, you know, been hit by a collapsing roof, or, you know, had sort of breathing problems or anything up to that point in time, anybody left alive would have been wiped out by the noxious gases that come through Pompeii at this point in time. And so that's why you find a significant amount of the deaths that took place in Pompeii took place because of asphyxiation. So not being able to breathe properly when these surges are hitting the town. But as I said, if they're hit around the third or the fourth surge, then that means that the city is still going to be inundated with volcanic material for a number of hours after anybody who's in Pompeii are dead. You know, it would have continued on for a little bit longer, and it starts to sort of peter out when we're sort of talking about the sort of middle to end of that second day. It starts to slow down, and the volcanic eruption starts to subside.
I mean, are there other examples of like in recorded history where you have the exact those kind of surges? I mean, it's pretty rare, I imagine, but it just hasn't happened with other heavily densely populated areas, or is it something that's like extremely rare?
Yeah, there have been a couple of modern examples that if your listeners want to look it up and have a look, because my students always enjoy, not that they revel in destruction, but it's quite spectacular, and this is why Pliny the Elder wanted to go and check it out for himself, right? So if you look up videos of in the 1980s, there was an eruption in the US of Mount St. Helena, I think, or Mount St. Helens.
Yeah, St. Helens.
Yes, St. Helens, yeah. You can see video of a similar kind of effect, and you can see the surges happening. And I mean, it is horrible, because you see these trees that were, you know, you see this little lush forested area, and then you see the surge coming down the mountain. And then when you look around, these trees are just horizontal. I mean, the force of the explosion of Vesuvius, it's bigger than an atom bomb. You know, it's hard to comprehend, I think, without actually seeing what would happen. I mean, literally really heavy pieces of like marble that had been, you know, mounted, you know, for people to use, you know, to wash or whatever, were blown across, you know, to another side of the room. Anything that hadn't been covered by volcanic material in a place like Pompeii was mostly just blown away in the surges. That's why we don't often get second stories in Pompeii, because a lot of it is just blown away. You know, things that are kind of above human head height, they tend to just be obliterated by the force of this volcanic eruption. And that's why we get the kind of nature of preservation that we do. Herculaneum's a little bit different, because it was kind of preserved in this pyroclastic material, which, you know, sort of seeped into the site a little bit slower and then hardened and solidified, and so protected it in a different way, or preserved it in a different way for later archaeologists to come along and find. But yeah, certainly Pompeii, you can see the full force of this volcanic eruption.
Yeah, it's terrifying to imagine. Just this, like, I mean, I'm petrified of even earthquakes. I don't think I could ever live at the base of a volcano. It just seems like a bad idea.
And it's still active. It's actually overdue for another one of these.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd want to be living there right now, to be honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, in your neck of the woods, I mean, down in New Zealand, there was an explosion not that long ago on White Island.
Yeah. We're very lucky, actually.
My brother was actually on the island the week before.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we're pretty... Yeah, New Zealand is a very active region, and Australia sort of sits just outside of all of those. It's on its own plate, effectively, and so we are blessedly pretty much volcano free. At least all of ours are very much extinct. But for somewhere like when we're thinking about Italy, there's that whole region where the two plates are sort of touching each other. And it runs down the whole of center of Italy, and Mount Etna is part of that same chain as well. So, and they're quite active. Certainly, Etna is going all the time, basically, in various ways.
Yeah. There was a lot of debris and such blowing out not too long ago, I think. I randomly also have a friend who got struck by lightning on the top of Mount Etna. So I don't know. Maybe that's
that is very unlucky.
Oh my God, wouldn't want to be odds.
Yeah, like the full lightning bolt straight through the body and everything.
Are they okay?
Yes, after, fortunately. But I was very interested about also how the current like Roman government dealt with such an extreme natural disaster. I know Titus was in power at the time. Did he do any sort of relief? How is he sort of involved in helping the community, the refugees? I imagine there would have been a lot of refugees from this. Was there any kind of policy, or it changed the dynamics of the communities?
Yeah, around? There's a huge sense in which Titus sets up relief. And certainly, and as Dr. Rad was saying, we think that most people survived. As tragic as it clearly is to go into these sites and to sort of bear witness, particularly in Herculaneum, where a lot of the skeletal remains can still be seen, it gives that sense of utter destruction. But we're pretty sure that most people survive. And Titus does set up a relief for survivors to help them out, because they certainly, there's no intention at this stage to properly rebuild. There's some ideas that maybe that they would, and that comes through in Suetonius's life of Titus. He talks about this idea that maybe they could have a rebuilding program, but it doesn't seem to eventuate in terms of the archaeological evidence, not in any substantial way. And I think the shock of this moment and the destructive force of what has taken place has really put the Romans on a back step. And it's like, what do we do now? And certainly it's a traumatic sort of environment as well, to see the utter destruction of a place where you've lived and the idea that maybe you could build another life here when it now seems so completely untenable to do so.
Yeah, and as we sort of talked about with the surges and the fact that they had a, you know, a bigger radius that they were hitting as the eruption went on, it obviously isn't just Pompeii and Herculaneum that are impacted. There are lots of small settlements around the area that are also being excavated now, and have been excavated in the past, which were also affected. You know, so it is actually quite an quite an astonishingly wide radius that Vesuvius manages to hit, because this is, I mean, this is probably one of the, you know, top three volcanic eruptions of all time in terms of how serious it is. You know, the world has not seen many volcanic eruptions quite as large as this one. And to be honest, there probably are a lot of people whose bodies lie outside of the towns, you know, that were trying to escape or in the process of escaping and were cut down whilst trying to flee. But just because their bodies aren't within the towns themselves, we don't necessarily obviously know where to look or where to find them, and they're probably just going to be discovered by accident as, you know, as time goes on, or they, you know, unfortunately have been lost to time, you know, haven't been preserved in the same way that the bodies at Pompeii and Herculaneum have. But certainly this was such a big effect on the whole region. And I think the other complicated thing for poor Titus is that even though he only rules by himself for a couple of years, but he's facing more than one disaster in his reign. There's also some...
I was going to say there's a big fire in Rome. I mean, for a short rule, he's really plagued by disaster. Yeah. There was also a plague.
But certainly... one of the things that comes through in our source material about Titus is that he does have the idea of using the estates of people who have died in this disaster and don't have any heirs to supporting the people that have survived. So there does seem to have been, like, normally that money probably would have actually just gone to the emperor, like to the state, but there does seem to be an idea that he has of redirecting that funding towards people that are going to really need it. One of the really interesting studies that's happening at the moment with a historian and archaeologist called Stephen Tuck is he's actually starting to use modern technology to trace, because obviously Roman names are fairly they're fairly formulaic, and you can kind of trace families because they tend to reuse the same names over and over, obviously. He's using databases and computer technology to start to actually track the movement of refugees from places like Pompeii to sort of see what happened to them. Can we actually trace their journey? Like, where did they go and live after this has all happened? And he has actually started to find some families. So he's found this one particular family called the Caninia, who seem to have moved from Herculaneum to Naples. And he's done that by tracking, you know, tracking where they pop up in the records. Now, obviously, that's a that's a long-term project there, you can tell. And it's obviously not going to be easy because a lot of people, unfortunately, they live and they don't leave a trace. But it is such a fascinating idea to, rather than just focusing on the eruption and the people that died, to actually start focusing on the people who lived.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. I mean, it was actually what I was going to be asking about, because you're mentioning before about the dynamic of Pompeii not being full of Latins, that it was of a different background ethnically, and so and a very diverse group of people too. So, you know, coming to Houston, for instance, when the event of Katrina happened, you had huge refugees come from Louisiana to Texas, and a lot of those people have stayed. And so you see that the dynamics of the population, you know, setup, demographics have forever changed after a natural disaster that happened elsewhere. So I can imagine that considering the scale, it would have changed the whole region in Italy, that different neighborhoods and different communities and different cities would have had a completely different demographic from the like kind of outspurge of these refugees.
We could only imagine, but as I said, that kind of study is only in its infancy at the moment. And as I say, it's going to be, I think, a challenging one because, yeah, everyday people, you know, they don't always leave their mark in the historical record that we might like. But I think it is a fascinating one. And certainly with the ability that computers have to track patterns and, you know, the amount of information that you can plug into systems now, it's obviously much easier than it would have been, you know, 50 years ago to try and conduct a study like this.
And speaking of evidence, I mean, so we obviously have the sites themselves, and then we have Pliny.
Yes.
Do we have much else other than Pliny? Or maybe if you can give me like a 2-second synopsis summary of Pliny as well for those who are a little unfamiliar with his instrumental role in the records of this event.
Yeah, well, he's obviously someone who's personally affected by the eruption, not just because he actually, you know, he obviously saw it happening in the distance, and then it's so severe that it starts to affect where he is, even though it's, you know, like ages away, like it's not super close, but he certainly is experiencing ground shocks, and, you know, he's experiencing that whole phenomenon of day becoming night. You know, it's obviously something that he lived through, but more than that, his uncle Pliny the Elder, who had a fascination with the natural world and what was going on around him. There are a number of reasons why he seems to have gone to check out the volcano, but the bottom line is he does go and check out the volcano and he dies not in Pompeii, not in Herculaneum, but it seems in a place called Stabiae, where he had taken shelter. And yeah, so he lost a family relative who seems to have been obviously quite dear to him and quite important to him in this eruption. But his eyewitness accounts, it's important to remember, weren't actually written down until about 20 years after the eruption had happened. So he is writing with a certain amount of hindsight, I suppose. And he is also writing to a friend who is a historian, and he knows that he's writing a history. It seems that, and I'm sure your listeners will know, Tacitus, one of the most famous historians of, you know, of the Roman world, it seems that Tacitus had actually approached Pliny and asked him for his eyewitness account when he was writing his histories, which was his account, which unfortunately we have very little of surviving. But yeah, he seems to have asked Pliny, can you tell me what happened? And so Pliny wrote him a couple of letters about what happened. And luckily we have those letters, but they were.
And they're kind of literary artifacts as much as they are historical evidence, yeah, in a way, because when you read, so the really famous letter is letter from 16 from book 6, where he's writing to Tacitus, giving this account and being like, thank you so much for asking me this question. I really want to talk about what happened to my uncle. I'm like, I'm so thrilled that you asked. Let me put it all down. And he has these caveats at the end. He's like, you know, this account is based upon the most reliable eyewitnesses. And, you know, I've really gone about sourcing my material appropriately. And obviously it's coming from me. But within the context of the letter, he's also writing as if he was there with his uncle, as his uncle progresses through this journey, to the extent that he kind of suggests what was in his uncle's mind. And it sort of feels like you've been embedded into a narrative at that point, because at the point at which his uncle goes off to check out the volcano, and Pliny the Younger says, oh no, I think I'll stay here, thanks. Yeah, I've got to study.
You gave me
work to do. I'll be doing that over here. Have fun. From that point onwards, he cannot possibly really know. And so the fact that he creates this amazing sort of story for what his uncle goes through, feeling ill, lying down, having to be woken up during the night because the place that he's ended up in. So the elder Pliny has crossed over to Stabiae, has stayed there, has set up, sort of been like, let's get some accommodation. Has to be woken up in the middle of the night, apparently, because the pumice and the ashfall is now so high that he's about to get stuck in this building. They're like, we got to get out of here.
They tie some pillows onto their heads.
Yeah, all of this sort of fascinating level of detail. And then particularly we get the moment where, tragically, he lies down sort of like because he's having trouble breathing and passes away. And all of this is given to us as if we were there, which is, to me, just incredible as a piece of evidence. But it really emphasizes that literary artifice that's also at play. But you can't deny that the details are fascinating. And I'm really interested in the fact as well that some people get very excited about the possibility that they might have found the body of the elder Pliny.
I know.
This idea that somehow this particular skeleton might be him. And I wouldn't want to endorse that theory one way or the other. I think it would be very difficult to know. And also we get a sense from Pliny the Younger's letter that they actually did see the body. They went over a couple of days later and found it. So at that point, even though it is left unsaid, it strikes me as being a very odd thing that they might not have taken that body with them for a proper burial. So that's the big question that I have around that piece of evidence.
Yeah, I think you get the sense that when you read through Pliny's letters, he definitely wants his uncle to be a heroic figure in Tacitus's account, or just, you know, in the eyes of posterity. And you can only assume, and this is if we're being kind to Pliny, that a lot of his account of what happened after his uncle had set sail must have been related to him by some slaves that were in attendance to his uncle, because they are mentioned, they are around, they are attending to his uncle. So there is the possibility that they were the source of information, but it's no way made clear how Pliny the Younger knows all of that information. I think the big area for the letters where Pliny receives praise and where we can kind of fact check what he's telling us is with the natural phenomena that he was observing. So obviously the way that the cloud grew in the distance, the shape that it took, and then of course the impacts in the area where he was staying, so experiencing violent earth shocks which became worse as the eruption went on, but also this idea that the sea was retreating, because being in the kind of area and you know, with the volcanic activity that there is in this region, that was definitely a phenomenon where the sea, you know, the sea levels would have changed as there was volcanic activity. So sometimes it would have been further in, sometimes it would have been further away. That is definitely something we know that happens in that area. So him observing the movements of the sea is definitely something that tracks with what we now know about volcanic eruptions.
It's so amazing how so many times you read these histories from long ago and people think, oh, that's not possible. And then with time, we're like, well, actually, that is possible. I feel like Herodotus has gotten, you know, a bit of rejuvenation of late, as every now and then they're like, wait, that boat did exist. Or, you know, wait, maybe we should give him a little bit more credit. But I do wonder, would Pliny the Younger have written anything earlier than 20 years after the date, or is it just the 20 years after the date he wrote something that has then been preserved, you know, 1,000 years later? Or would he have written anything more recently to the event?
What we have are the letters that were written quite some time later. It is possible that I mean, we have quite a lot of Pliny's writings. I suppose it is possible that somewhere else he had made a record of the events. I mean, given his uncle's fascination with the natural world and the fact that his uncle is well known for having written this natural history where he preserved all sorts of interesting facts about how things work, some of which are more reliable than others. It's very possible that he did write down what he observed, because certainly, as I say, there is a startling amount of accuracy when it comes to the eruption itself. I mean, he actually describes witnessing the pyroclastic surge. You know, he describes seeing the cloud collapse and come crashing down and reaching out over the sea. You know, so a lot of those details do seem very accurate. It's possible that he did make a note to himself, or he, you know, wrote to someone else or something like that, and he was referring to those notes when he wrote. But we can only say what we have, what has survived for us. And that is these two letters, which, you know, are obviously trying to get in Tacitus's good books, where he's saying, oh, you are such a grand historian, you know, let me tell you a tale that will be worthy of your telling. You know, he's really buttering him up. So they are much more literary than I think people realize.
But I think you're onto something with the sense that there seems to be a pretty strong correspondence between his description of the eruption and what we understand about these eruptions now. And I think that's the thing that really strongly puts him in our favor as a source, because we've got the archaeological site and we've got modern volcanologists who have started to look into this in various ways. And it seems that Pliny's account is coming out pretty strong. What I'm fascinated about is the date, because if hypothetically he did keep some notes, how could he get that part wrong? Or did he get that part wrong?
Well, I think it's because of I think it's because we have about, obviously we don't have the original letter. What we have are copies, and there are about 16 different dates preserved across the copies that have been made of Pliny's letter. And it's just that this particular August 24 is the one that stuck for a really long time, and one that was widely accepted for a really long time. And as I say, it's only really in the past, you know, probably I suppose the past sort of 5 years that started to be seriously questioned, but definitely in the last couple of years with the uncovering of that charcoal inscription that we have actually said, you know what, I think it's just a copying error or something like that. Something's got lost in translation, and we are looking at a later eruption than we have thought for a really long time.
Yeah, because the bodies have a lot of extra clothing, and the food was from later in the harvest. I mean, there's like so much evidence to say later on in the year, right? That it just is the only reason people thought it was earlier is that one date.
There is a mixture of evidence in terms of the archaeology. It's not just the date, and certainly things like heavier clothing, you could potentially explain that because people are obviously rugging up because they're getting hit by, you know, volcanic material, and they're like, ah, and they don't want it to touch their bare skin. And so, yeah, I think you could explain the heavier clothing in other ways to make it work.
It is amazing, though, that there's this like huge event that, you know, is something that kind of is one of the few things from the ancient world that I think is in the popular consciousness. Like, people know about Pompeii, they know Vesuvius. I think a lot of people don't know the details about it, but it's something kind of everybody sort of knows about. And yet in the ancient world, you know, you have this massive event. Do we really only have one person writing about it, really?
Well, I mean, there are, of course, the people that write about it in the sense of they mention it as something that Titus had to deal with, you know, like Suetonius and Dio. We do have those sorts of accounts where they mention it because Titus had to respond and do something about this huge disaster. But certainly we don't have like these really in-depth histories of, you know, Pompeii, the town that was destroyed, in the way that we do in the modern
world.
Yeah,
we really have like taken the consciousness of it. And I guess a huge part of that is just the uniqueness of the archaeological site and the discovery of it. And I mean, that in of itself is an interesting tale. Like, how was it discovered, the day, the moment?
Yeah. Well, I think for a long time, people have kind of thought that it was forgotten about. But I think now, again, most people agree that it was never forgotten about. You know, people were aware that there were towns, you know, that had existed in this region. And certainly in the immediate aftermath of the destruction, when archaeologists have excavated the towns, they found these tunnels, which at first they were like, oh, well, of course, people got trapped and, you know, tried to come out. But actually, that's people going back in, you know, to try, you know, maybe to try and loot from the site, to try and look for things, who knows. But certainly people in the aftermath were tunneling back into the site. So people didn't forget. Just as soon as they were covered, they went like,
nothing well, there. Yeah. Guys, no, no, no.
Yeah, but they were preserved obviously in quite different ways. So Pompeii is buried under about, you know, 5 kilometers worth of 5 meters worth of volcanic material. Yeah, that would be a lot. About 5 meters worth of volcanic material. So, you know, pumice, ash, lapilli, all that kind of stuff. But Herculaneum is like 20 meters underground in this like volcanic rock, essentially, that, you know, once it cooled, it's incredibly difficult, you know, to dig through. So they were kind of left alone for a long time. But certainly there are maps that have survived that seem to indicate that people were aware, you know, where they existed. But in about 1592, a guy called Domenico Fontana, who was the court architect for the Austrian Habsburgs, who were at that time in charge of Naples, started uncovering unusual finds like huge slabs of marble and, you know, bits of frescoed wall when he was undertaking a different construction project. And so he couldn't quite figure out where it was from, but he was like, well, clearly there is something here that's feeding, you know, feeding this material. So I suppose, as is the usual story in Italy, you know, you start to build something and you come across a ruin. And so that's kind of how it started to be uncovered. But it really wasn't until quite a bit later, you know, about 100 years later, that we have another find that was quite significant. So there's a stone found in about 1689 by another court architect, which has a Latin inscription on it. It says Decurio Pompeius. And the person who found it was like, Pompeius, like Pompey, maybe? Pompey the Great? I know that guy. But of course, this is a reference to the town. And it seems that some people at the time recognized that that's probably what it was a reference to, but it wasn't necessarily, you know, widely thought about in that way. But as you enter into the 1700s, you start to get people who uncover Herculaneum. Okay, Herculaneum actually receives, I think, a bit more dedicated archaeology time, excavation time at this point. And so, yeah, they sort of discover it by accident, and then they start to, you know, dig further into it, and they're kind of amazed by the things that they start to uncover at Herculaneum. And so there are excavations that are going on most of the sort of 1700s that we're talking about, obviously some periods of bigger activity than others, but they start creating a lot of tunnels into the site so that they can start exploring this amazing underground world.
I think we should also mention here that when we're talking about excavations, we're not talking about them at this stage is happening in a very systematic way at all. These are very sort of arbitrary sort of expeditions, usually headed up by people in power who want to impress other people in power. And a lot of the stuff that's happening in the 1700s is dedicated to specific removal of stuff that looks good. So tunneling in, finding what you can, coming across a gem, ripping it out and taking it back to a palace.
Yeah, there's not a lot of systematic excavation happening at this time. That you do occasionally get the odd person who's a bit more interested in exploring something.
And people tend to laugh at them, though, at this period. They're like, oh, you're just moving dirt around.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And they really are just looking for the impressive finds. It's like the rulers of Naples at this time to like, what would make me look the most cultured and civilized? I know, couple of frescoes from this place that we have found. I'll put them into my wall. I'll have some treasures on display. But they're really not interested in the artifacts of day-to-day life at all. You know, they kind of just either toss them aside or sometimes deliberately destroy them. And certainly in this period as well, because a lot of the people that are, I mean, it's really treasure hunting what they're doing. Because a lot of people who are engaged in this activity are doing it on behalf of the rulers of Naples and to impress, you know, people in power, if they find two of the one thing, they'll destroy the other one so that what the ruler has.
You're breaking my heart.
Yeah. It's pretty soul-destroying.
I always think about that when the fire mummy wood and they needed it to burn some of the wood to keep the fire warm. And I'm like, I understand being warm, but
stop.
Yeah. But it means that basically by about 1748, Herculaneum has been fairly thoroughly looted. You know, people have gone in, they've got what they came for, and they've left. And so they do start looking at Pompeii again with a bit more interest. But for them at this point in time, they find the progress of excavating at Pompeii quite slow. And whilst Pompeii was the larger city with seemingly more bustling trade, Herculaneum does seem to have had potentially a slightly more wealthy group of people living there. And so what they're finding at Pompeii is a little bit more of the everyday stuff. I mean, it's a much larger site as well. So obviously you're going to have a lot more variety of people living there as well. But they're finding that Pompeii is a little bit more difficult. They're, you know, unpocketing, like, you know, gas and that kind of thing. And it's just a little bit more tricky at this point in time. And given what they want, they're just like, just give me the treasure. Give it to me quickly. And they're not really getting that much satisfaction from Pompeii. So they kind of leave like a skeleton crew there and then they turn their attention.
But even in this period, like if we're talking about like the late 1700s, already by now, the reputation of this area as being something that you've got to come and see has happened. And so we get a really famous quotation from Goethe in his Italian journey, saying many disasters have occurred in the world, but there are few that would have given those living afterwards so much joy. And this is him describing what it was like for him to go and see Pompeii. So even with the excavation work being done in this really sort of haphazard fashion and the good stuff being carried off and things being destroyed, word is getting out that this is a place to see. And I think having those people also come through in this time period is probably something that also leads to further sort of inspiration for looting as well.
Yeah, and it's mostly people who are, you know, elite, foreign dignitaries, royalty, that kind of thing, that are allowed to come and visit the excavations. I'm using
we can see them on video.
at this point in time. I know, but just in case the video doesn't work. It's mostly those sorts of people that have legitimate access to the sites. But it's in 1763 that they discover an inscription which seems to confirm that, yes, this other site we've been looking at is definitely Pompeii. And the more material that they shift from Pompeii, it does start to become, as Dr. G was saying, this sort of wonderful open air museum kind of site, you know, that people can come and stroll through and see what is happening. And it's then that the people that are in charge of the excavation start to go, hang on a second, this is a tourism opportunity extraordinaire. And so they start actually thinking about how they can stage the excavations to attract the most interest. And so, of course, you start to get, you know, very famous stories about bodies that they found being posed in certain ways in certain houses, or if they know someone special is coming, they make sure that as they walk past, they're like, oh, look, oh, it's a body. Amazing that you should happen to be visiting at the same time we uncover a skeleton, you know. And so you get those sorts of stories starting to come out by the time we're moving into the latter part of the 1700s.
Wow, I had no idea that the tourism of it went so far back. It was always a draw, I suppose. I mean, it makes sense, but...
Yeah, well, not super widespread. Definitely something that I think mostly, you know, people who are fairly well off would have been able to do, but certainly enough that it starts to really enter, you know, the consciousness, I suppose, of the world. Yeah.
And for people who aren't really in the know-how of the most recent archaeological news, there have been a lot of really cool discoveries of late. I mean, you guys mentioned that there's a reason now to believe that it was much later on. I think there was some money found, but there's some other cool ones that have been making the headlines.
Yeah. So many.
To be honest, there is like so much there. It's hard to talk about it all. And that's partly because people are probably aware that in the 1990s and early 2000s, both Pompeii and Herculaneum were in a very dangerous, precarious situation. And I think Herculaneum, because it's so deep, there's a real issue with the groundwater there. Water is a real problem that they've always been battling with the site. So Herculaneum started to get attention a little bit earlier than Pompeii, but Pompeii certainly hit, you know, news headlines around the world. You know, sort of between 2008 to 2013, there were a lot of stories coming out about how Pompeii was, you know, in danger of collapsing and disappearing forever. But there's been a huge amount of change in the past 5 years. And in the last couple of years, in order to shore up some parts of the site, they actually have commenced excavations, which is definitely not something they were doing during these very, you know, precarious years for both of the sites. You know, there were periods where there was just a flat out moratorium where there were no excavations happening because they couldn't preserve what they had uncovered, let alone uncover more. Because there are parts of this, both sites that aren't excavated. Herculaneum, part of the town, can't really be excavated because there's a modern town sitting on top. And for Pompeii, about 2/3 of the site had been excavated, but as they couldn't preserve what they had there, they didn't want to keep going. But recently in an area called Regia 5, there have been excavations going on. And so the amount of material that is coming out is quite
impressive. It's kind of like a Renaissance period for Pompeii in many respects, because a sort of a fundamental funding decision was made to really support the work at Pompeii, at least to stabilize the site initially. And that's now progressed to a stage where they can actually start to engage in new excavations as well. And so the stuff that's now coming out is kind of really quite exciting, because it's on the back of a lot of structural foundational work to make sure the site is stabilized and can be accessed, because they went through a period where they were actually closing down access points and places that used to be open to tourists were shut. And there was a lot of outcry that the whole place was kind of just falling apart. And now we've got things like this amazing sort of like fast food outlet that has been discovered, where everybody's very excited about this, not because we weren't aware that fast food was a thing that Romans did. We definitely knew that. But finding a place that is the whole kit and caboodle, the real setup where you can walk in, choose from a dish, and it's all lined up for you, and they'll just scoop it out and give it to you. You can see them cooking it out the back. That is kind of one of those amazing sort of moments where people are like, oh, they really are like us. You know, they want their food and they want it now. Give it to me. Give it to me.
Yeah, I think that connecting to the humanness in history is always so fascinating, because, you know, we can read the books and we can learn the lessons and such, but to be reminded that thousands of years ago people were still people, I feel like it's so humbling, or it gives you kind of a new perspective on your own life, but it also brings to life ancient history. So I think that's something that has always been really remarkable about Pompeii. When you're walking on the site and, you know, you're stepping from stone to stone and you're there, you really get to be part of it, and it just makes it so much more alive.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that hasn't actually really changed much over the centuries that we've had access to these sites. Back in the early days when they were, you know, treasure hunting and uncovering these sites, one of the strongest impulses was to assign identities and characters to the bodies that were uncovered, and to imagine you know, what some of the spaces that maybe it wasn't clear what was going on, you know, in this particular house or this, you know, particular area in Pompeii. And so people really gave into storytelling. And you can see that in novels like the very famous Last Days of Pompeii. You can see that in the, you know, dozens of movies that have been made about the last days of Pompeii. But even though we flatter ourselves, I think that we're more analytical now. And while certainly a lot of the people who are, you know, legitimately involved in the site certainly are, as Dr. G was highlighting with that news story about the body of Pliny the Elder being uncovered, we still have this tendency because we feel that very strong human connection with these sites to storytell and to create identities around the finds, create stories around the finds. And so I think that that's kind of fascinating for me, the fact that, you know, we really haven't changed all that much in then, you know, when you uncover things, particularly bodies, because there have been some new bodies discovered in the past couple of years, not just the Pliny one, we do tend to, you know, start telling stories about them. I mean, there was that particularly famous body that was discovered, which seemed to be a man who was lying, you know, face down, and there was this huge block lying on top of his head, this huge block of stone. And it became like this huge meme thing. Everyone was like, oh my God, this poor guy is like running away. And then this block is like, but then as they started to excavate, they realized that actually he had fallen and died. And then the stone had just happened to dislodge and sit on top of his body. His skull was actually in perfect condition. That wasn't what killed him. But yeah, we just, as soon as we get a whiff of identity around these people, or, you know, a whiff of what their story was, we're just off and running.
Yeah, I guess we can't really feel too bad, maybe we shouldn't be too harsh on Pliny the Younger for creating a story back then when we're doing the exact same thing now. Now, I was going to ask you basically just to finish up, because I know you guys have already taken up so much of your time. I wanted to ask what your like favorite surprising revelation from Pompeii is.
Ooh. Look, I think that one of the really fascinating things to look at from the site is the graffiti. Because so much, Dr. G and I are both more historians than anything. You know, we look at literary evidence, we're not archaeologists. And so we tend to deal with texts that are written by men from the elite. That's pretty much what we get. Whereas whilst there are obviously lots of issues with the graffiti and that you can't always be sure when it was written or who wrote it or any of that kind of stuff, it does at least give you the chance of seeing what an average person, woman, child, slave, you know, person who's a local, person who's come from afar, you know that you're looking at a more everyday kind of material, whether it's a doodle or whether it's a piece of writing. And I think that that's quite fascinating because there is just so much of it all throughout Pompeii, you know, it's covered in it. And there are some great projects that are trying to document and study the graffiti that's being uncovered. And I just love looking at it because you get these crude jokes and, you know, just all sorts of everyday things that people are writing down about, like, you know, which is the best prostitute to go to and how much she charges and for what. It really does give you a sense of the life of the town.
I think for me, I might pick two things if I can, because one of the things that really fascinates me is the recent ornament box with all of the small little figurines and beads in it. And the pictures of them, they're all brightly colored. It's kind of like this gorgeous collection. We don't know really what it was for. And it's found as part of Reggio 5 in a house which also contained bodies of what seemed to be a family. And this seemed to me to be a really keen insight into everyday life, you know, the collection of small items that accrue value through your possession of them. And I think, you know, we're all sort of bowerbirds in our own way. And to me, that sort of represented something really essential about daily life and, you know, how you build collections over time and what you decide is valuable enough to keep, even if it's not valuable per se. And the other thing that really has stood out for me, and this is from Herculaneum, not from Pompeii, is the study work into the vitrification that may have happened to some of the people, and a recent study that has been done looking at what appears to be glass, but which they think was a person's brain, and what state change had happened to that brain as it endured that pyroclastic surge. And to me, this is this kind of thing where it's like, it's almost incomprehensibly horrific that this is the thing that has happened. And yet it seems relatively demonstrable evidence for keeping in mind that this is a horrifying moment in history. And for the people that endured this, that's part of the thing that we have to hold on to as well. It's a spectacular sight, and both Pompeii and Herculaneum are amazing in their own ways. And yet it is a sight of destruction, and it's a sight where we want to hold on to that possibility of that tragedy and recognizing that tragedy for the human cost that it had.
Very well said. It's in the end of the day, it's still a memorial site as well as an archaeological site, but that to remember that. Yeah. Very well said.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, for listeners who are interested in that side of things, the Pompeii Cast Project might be worth following. Over the past 5 years, that particular project led by people like Estelle Laser have really completely changed the way that we look at the plaster casts, how they were made, and what's actually inside of them. And that's ongoing work. So if your listeners are interested, they can follow the updates on the Pompeii Cast Project website.
Perfect. I'll put those links below. And I also want to plug you guys and tell my listeners about your awesome podcast, The Partial Historians. Maybe you could just say one last thing about what you guys are working on right now, the cool stuff you guys have been talking about, and how my listeners can find you.
Absolutely. Well, we can be found, we're most active on Twitter, but we can be found on Instagram and Facebook as well. And Dr. G, do you want to tell them what we've
okay,
been
so
about
we're
recently?
Right in the middle of the history of Rome from the foundation. And by the middle, I mean the beginning. So we've just been looking at the struggle of the orders recently, which has led us into the decemvirate. First and now the second. So we're kind of in this dense political period of early Roman Republican history. And I would say we're doing a pretty deep dive. We definitely won't be done by the time our lives are over. But if you'd want to join us for that journey, you can find The Partial Historians wherever you listen to excellent podcasts.
And we do, of course, also have a website.
Wonderful. Thank you. I'll put links down for that as well. And thank you again for taking the time to chat with me. And I hope everybody enjoyed learning a bit more about Pompeii and Vesuvius.
Thank you so much for having us.